rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Siegel, Judge Peterson, the Honorable Gene Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have six cases on our calendar today, four oral, two non-oral. The first case is in the matter of Rodney Miller, petitioner, versus Pamela Miller, now known as Pamela Spera. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes.
Okay. And Maria Malloy, intervener appellant. Counsel will each have 15 minutes for their argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you can please introduce yourself when you start your argument and the party you represent, that would be much appreciated. And then the the podium does go up and down, so feel free to adjust that as needed. You can proceed when you're ready.
Ready. And may it please the court, my name is David Cox. I'm the attorney representing the appellant in this case. Her name is Maria Malloy, and she is intervening in the case that the court just described on behalf of her daughter, Christina Malloy. And the issues to be decided today are whether or not the respondent's motion in this case is barred by the applicable statute of limitations, a 10-year statute of limitation, and whether or not the appellant may be or is entitled to intervene in this action in order to protect her daughter's interests.
Can I ask you, if you were to prevail and allowed to intervene, what would you expect to happen next?
If we the next thing that should happen is the court should determine that the motion brought by the respondent is barred by the statute of limitations.
So if you prevail on that, then what would happen?
If the matter is barred by the statute of limitations, then the respondent's motion should be dismissed.
Right, but how?
Denied.
What are you going to do with these IRAs?
Well, then the next thing to do is to take that order to the financial institutions and show that to them and resolve the dispute. Because as I understand it, and this maybe respondent can speak more to this than I can, but as I understand it, respondent initially, before bringing this motion, went to the financial institutions and tried to get a distribution of.
So what would that order do, though? As I look at the order that you're appealing, it says that the parties are each entitled to half of all of these various IRAs, which is what that seems to me the judgment and decree said. But still, the judgment and decree was shown to those financial institutions, and some of them said, what are we supposed to do with this?
Right, and again, I don't know exactly what happened prior to respondent filing her motion, but that's my understanding.
What would happen now in order to straighten out their concern that they don't know what to do?
I think we would have an order in this case from the Court of Appeals, and then presumably from the lower court as well, saying that her motion is denied, and that she doesn't have the right to enforce the decree after all of this time, and therefore the financial institutions would then be free to distribute the funds according to the beneficiary designations.
So your expectation would be that what? That the IRAs in his name would be his and the IRAs in her name would be hers?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
If we were to agree with you on your argument about the motion to intervene, would it be appropriate for this court to address the statute of limitations issue, given that the district court didn't really address that in any real detail?
I'm sorry, I missed just the very first part of the question.
If we were to agree with you on your argument regarding the motion to intervene,
okay,
is it appropriate for this court to address the statute of limitations question?
I think it is, Your Honor, because the referee in the court below did rule that or conclude that the statute of limitations does not apply. And if this court doesn't rule on that issue, we remand to the district court, we intervene, and then we still have that issue in front of the referee.
But isn't there a footnote on page 5 of the order saying, without ruling on the application of Minnesota Statute 541.04 or the doctrine of latches?
There is, but at the same time, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals, or sorry, here the Court of Appeals, the referee held that the statute of limitations does not apply. And I'm looking for the...
In discussing the motion to intervene.
Yes, at least in the court's order, it was like paragraph, I think, 24, the court, you know, clearly said that it doesn't apply. And I think I've got a direct quote here, if I can just find it. Right. Yeah, it says, the referee ruled and concluded that enforcement and clarification of the judgment and decree herein is not subject to such statute of limitations. And so I agree with Your Honor. There is some sort of ambiguity, because on the one hand, she says, well, I'm not ruling on that. On the other hand, she ruled on it, and here we are. And
did that issue get presented to the referee, or was that statement that you just quoted just something the referee came up with on her own?
The issue of the statute of limitations was most definitely litigated in front of the referee. It was in our original motion. I wrote a couple of pages about that in our motion to intervene. Respondent responded to it in her responsive papers.
So the referee heard all that.
Oh yeah.
Then said something about it, but also specifically said, "I'm not deciding it."
Yes, it's again sort of ambiguous, because on the one hand she says, "Well, I'm not ruling on that," but on the other hand she quite clearly said it doesn't apply. And I think the law is quite clear that it does apply. We've got a plain, unambiguous, nice, simple statute that says no action shall be maintained upon a judgment or decree unless begun within 10 years after entry of judgment. And some of the cases that I found on this also noted that, there's other statutes of limitations that apply here, which would be MnStat 548.09 and 550.01, which likewise contemplate that you cannot enforce a judgment after 10 years.
I have a question with respect to my earlier line of questioning. In paragraph 36 of the judgment and decree, it says, to implement the terms and provisions contained herein, each of the parties shall make, execute, and deliver to the other party instruments of conveyance, assignment, and other documents as may be required. And that apparently is what didn't happen here. For some reason, nobody did anything about these IRAs, even though everybody had been ordered to divide them equally.
True.
In the event either party fails to do so, the judgment and decree shall operate as said conveyance. Why hasn't that conveyance essentially occurred now, but the paperwork's not done? I mean, they had 30 days to do that. Why didn't, on the 31st day, the judgment and decree act to be the conveyance that was ordered in the judgment?
Because the parties still had to take the steps to identify the values of their accounts
why
and transfer.
Why was that necessary at that time? I mean, it's not really clear to me on the judgment and decree what was expected. Hmm. Was each party just expected to say that I convey to the other one half of each of the IRAs that are in my name?
Well, I think it would be something more than that. I mean, the decree says that they're going to do that, but I think they had a duty to produce statements to each other and probably complete some paperwork with the financial institutions to accomplish that.
So the failure to do that, though, why does that have any bearing on anything other than the amount that needs to be conveyed now, that those financial institutions have to turn over to people now?
Well, because what is happening here is the respondent is, after 14 years trying to enforce this decree and say, I want to take half of the deceased petitioner's retirement accounts.
But it seems to me that the referee's order says that's true, but you also have to give up half of yours.
Right, and the referee's order says that, but the problem is, as it stands, there's no way to enforce that order. If appellant is not permitted to intervene in this case, there's nobody left.
That's why I asked my first line of questions. What would the intervener need to do at that point?
Well, I think the intervener intervenes and raises the statute of limitation defense, which then results in a denial of the respondent's motion.
But if this transfer occurred 14 years ago, or when I don't know the exact timeline here, why wasn't the, I mean, the property settlement or the property division is final. At that point, he became the owner of half of all of them. She became the owner of half of all of them. We just don't know what those halves are worth right now.
And we don't know, that's true.
So why do you need enforcement of the judgment to figure that out?
Well, I think that's a good question for the respondent. It is respondent's motion seeking to enforce it. And, Your Honor, it's no different than a divorce decree that has a property settlement that says you're going to pay me $15,000 for my share in the real estate, like the Dolly V. Nichols case that we cite in our brief. And then somebody doesn't pay. They don't make the payments that they're supposed to make. And certainly the decree may say you're supposed to do this. This decree can operate as a conveyance. But if you don't actually convey the property, whatever it is, the money or the real estate, whatever it is, it doesn't happen. And if you don't return to court within 10 years to make it happen, your claim is barred by the statute of limitation.
Counselor, though, but shouldn't Mr. Miller have designated the respondent here as a beneficiary, and that would have taken care of it? It wouldn't have done it within 30 days. But certainly upon his death, I mean, wasn't that problematic? And how do we deal with that? That he, contrary to the agreement, you know, the court's decree with the divorce, he designated other beneficiaries than what was provided for there. So what do we do with that? And isn't that then like the cases cited by respondent?
I'm very glad to be able to address this. This case is very different than the cases cited by a respondent. I beg to differ with Your Honor because on the issue of whether or not the deceased petitioner was obligated to name the respondent as a beneficiary to his retirement accounts. He was not. There is nothing in the decree that says he needs to name her or anybody as a beneficiary. And moreover, we can contrast that with a couple other provisions in the decree where he is required to get a life insurance policy, name the respondent and her children as beneficiaries of that life insurance policy to ensure his child support obligation. The parties also in the decree, which was drafted by the respondent, by the way, the parties also made very careful plans for what would happen with the homestead in the event one of them died before it was transferred. Okay, so clearly the parties had contemplated that somebody might die, and they had a beneficiary requirement for a life insurance policy, and they made plans for the homestead, but there's nothing about that in the decree with respect to the retirement accounts. And that's a fundamental difference between this case and the cases cited by the referee. The referee and the respondent's cases all involve divorce decrees where the husband was specifically expressly ordered to, you know, obtain a life insurance policy, name somebody as a beneficiary, and then went out and violated that order. And in that event, the court imposed a constructive trust on the proceeds. It's a completely different situation. There's no such requirement in this decree.
Going back to paragraph 36, doesn't the Mercord case suggest that the statute of limitations wouldn't apply in paragraph 36 because of paragraph 36?
I understand the court's question. Mercord is sort of an odd duck of a case. In that case, we have sort of a self-executing provision, right? And that's the comparison to paragraph 36 here, but it's not the same thing. Mercord was decided under the very, quote, peculiar facts of that case. I mean, I'm quoting right from the right from the decision. They said it was, you know, very, very peculiar facts. That involved the question of whether or not title or real estate passed to the husband, where he was required to make monthly payments, and the decree especially provided that once these payments are made in full, the title goes, you know, directly to him. I'm just gonna see if I have an exact quote here. No, I don't have the exact quote here, but that was the gist of it. Upon final payment, title is irrevocably vested in him. It was something along those lines, okay? So he made all the payments he was supposed to make, but the wife never deeded him title of the property.
There was a document issue there as here.
Yeah, there was, exactly. There was no, she never wrote a deed to him. Exactly. And the court expressly did not reach the issue of the statute of limitation. They said, we don't have to do that in this case because under the plain language of this decree, which says upon final payment, title is vested in husband.
So why isn't that what happened here on the 31st day? They failed to do what the decree called for, exchange the documents. So it says the judgment and decree acts as that conveyance. So why 31 days at the 31-day mark didn't half of each of these belong to each of them?
Again, it was very, and the Court of Appeals in that case said, under the very peculiar facts of this case, with the very specific language that they had written into that decree, which said, you know, this decree, you know, is transferring.
Right, but I'm looking at this decree that says that if they don't do what's called for here, the decree acts as the conveyance. So why didn't those conveyances occur as a result of just the passage of 31 days?
Because you still have to enforce it. I mean, in the McCord case, the husband or his estate could walk down to the county recorder and say, here's our divorce decree awarding me the you know, title of this property, and it's a done deal already. We don't need anything else.
Right, I mean, but all that needs to be done here is to figure out what those halves are now worth, isn't it?
That is what. Okay, if this case is not, you know, if it's not dismissed or if the respondent's motion is not denied, that is what needs to happen, and it's very important that appellant is permitted to intervene to make sure that that is what happens, because as it stands right now, there's nobody in this case that's going to do that. The last person left in this case is the respondent, and you know. If the appellant isn't entitled to intervene, there's no one to make sure that her share of her accounts is transferred to him, or basically that these accounts are properly offset.
Honest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Thank
Pretty
you.
Much.
Your time is up, but you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Spira for respondent. Please correct me if I mispronounced your name.
No, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. I'm sorry. May it please the court. My name is Pamela Spera. I am the respondent. Only a party may appeal an adverse judgment. Therefore, if this court affirms the district court's denial of the appellant's motion to intervene, then that this case ends on that note.
Then what would you imagine would happen? What's the next step in this case?
To submit the district court's order enforcing the judgment and decree to the investment firms.
What would they do with it? They need to know how much to write out the checks, make out the checks for. How would they know that? How would they figure that out?
Well, the district court's order says to enforce the judgment and decree.
Which says
which is to divide each of the parties' retirement firms. So the Vanguard investment firm, that's the simplest because I don't have an account at Vanguard. So submit it to Vanguard, they divide it in half.
But they divide it in half based on something that happened 15 years ago. How do they figure out how much they're supposed to give someone now?
The district court, that was the issue that the district court had us submit proposed orders on. So I did a lot of research on that. The way that I understand the district court's order, the wording, it isn't explicit, but the way that I understand it is that the value will be at the date of, it's not going to be back in 2004 because there's a lot of law that is not a just result because that's not dividing it according to the party's intent in the judgment and decree. So,
No, I'm not saying that they would. It seems to me that what needs to happen here is that we need to figure out what a half interest in each of these IRAs 31 days after the divorce is worth today. Isn't that what needs to happen? 31 days after the divorce, each of these parties owned half of all of these IRAs, didn't they? Or is that not the case?
Well, yes, and then the issue that we briefed was on, is the value determined back in 2004, or is it determined as of the date of the new order? And that was what, that's the way that I understand the order. So it isn't, there's also a qualification
so,
in.
Let me ask you though, I'm not sure I understand what your understanding is. 15 years ago, an IRA had $100,000 in it. So each of them at that point had half interest in it, so each of them had $50,000. Over 15 years, the market goes up, the market goes down, whatever. So today, each of those half interests is worth something other than $50,000.
Yes, exactly.
Is the expectation then that whatever those half interests are worth today is what each of these parties will get?
Yes, except for the qualification that if either party contributed to
right.
the IRA
and that couldn't
after.
Have been part of the value of the interest then because it hadn't occurred yet.
Yes, exactly.
So how are the investment companies or whoever's holding these things supposed to know what amount that is? Are they supposed to figure it out?
Well, I think it's just, so again, the Vanguard one is the simplest because there's only one party has that. And so the Dreyfus fund, only one party had it, but that one
right. so
apparently
each, but,
disappeared.
But at that time, so that means each of them owns a half interest in that.
Yes.
I have no idea what happened for either one of those accounts in the intervening years. People may have contributed to it. People may have made some withdrawals from it. I don't know, but it would seem to me that you'd have to trace all that to figure out what that's worth today.
And
each of their interests is worth today.
And from my conversations with the investment firm counselors, my understanding is they can do that. That's not, I even talked about, well, what if there was a contribution subsequent to the divorce decree, and they said, no problem,
so
we'll just figure it out.
So what language in the order would tell them that that's what they're supposed to do?
This is where I'm not sure if it's explicit. I think it's just the way that the order is written as far as Ms. Sparrow's motion for an enforcement judgment.
Paragraph 2 of the order, is that what you're reading?
Yes, I'm sorry, the last page.
Okay, so your understanding is that each of them is entitled to 50% of these IRAs as they existed 15 years ago. But now that value has changed, but whatever that 50% interest was then, to the extent you can demonstrate a change in the value of that interest, that's what each of them is entitled to now.
Yes.
You seem to suggest that there is a company that has retirement accounts both for you and your ex-husband. Is that correct?
Yes.
And how would you envision that situation being handled?
So that the order says, and so Mr. Cox is arguing that, oh, well, there's no way to enforce that. But the retirement companies, they would not.
How do you envision this affecting your retirement accounts, in other words? This order, the language in paragraph 2.
So, yes, I'm sorry. I took stalling. The way that it would work, so the Fidelity. When we submit the order, because the order doesn't tell Fidelity, give Ms. Sparrow half of Mr. Miller's. It says give Ms. Sparrow half of Mr. Miller's and give Mr. Miller half of Ms. Sparrow's. So the investment firms will do, the order tells them what to do. So that's why they'll divide them both. That's my understanding, because I don't understand, that's the enforcement. And Mr. Cox's argument that appellant gets to come in and be privy to all of our financial information, and there's no law to, that's a section in my brief.
Right,
there's
but why,
no law.
Why should they rely on you to get to the investment companies and all that and have them do that?
All I do is submit the order to the
Well, what if Mr. Miller hadn't died? How would this work? Right? Instead of dying, he had reached retirement age and wanted to start withdrawing from his IRAs and discovered that this, for whatever reason, the documentation that was supposed to occur didn't occur. What would be happening then?
I was waiting for Mr. Miller to say, yeah, fine, let's do it. He perfectly understood that we had this
What if you brought this motion when he was still alive? What if you brought this motion 14 years after the decree, but he was still alive?
From all my conversations with the firms, my understanding is I would have submitted it and they would have divided it. They would have followed the order because there would have not been a reason to not do it. They didn't follow it now because there was a conflict. So when I submit it to them and then they have beneficiaries that I'm not in, then they were like, well, we don't know what to do. So this all started because my conversation with Vanguard, the counselor said, he kept telling me we had to do probate, but I tried to explain a little bit of that in my affidavit. We couldn't do, probate wasn't going to work. Nobody lives in California. It was expensive. My daughters went to the probate court. They said, no, there's no money to do this. So then Mr. Harmon of Vanguard said, go back to the court and get the court to say the order is in full force and effect.
So what are they supposed to do?
That's all you need to do.
What are they supposed to do with the half interest in the accounts that are in your name? He's never designated a beneficiary for those, has he?
No, the accounts that are in my name, he gets half of.
Right, but what happens to them then? He's dead, and there's no beneficiary designated. Why isn't that a probate asset that has to go through probate?
Oh, because they are. I don't have any accounts that he doesn't have equal accounts. So Fidelity.
Right, but you don't own any of what he owns. I mean, it might be the same account, but he owns half of it. For some of these accounts, he has designated beneficiaries, but for some of them, he hasn't. I don't see how he couldn't designate a beneficiary for an account that's just in your name, could he?
Well, my understanding is he has a certain amount of money in Fidelity. Then he gets extra money because he gets half of my account.
Right.
So he has beneficiaries designated for Fidelity. So they'll just, those are his beneficiaries.
How would the beneficiaries designated in his Fidelity account have any impact on on whether there are beneficiaries in your Fidelity account? I mean, he can't designate beneficiaries for your account, can he?
I guess I'm treating it more as fungible. Like, it's just, well, this is, he. If he now has $100,000 in Fidelity and then he gets an extra 50, then now he has 150 and his beneficiaries will divide 150, not 100. That's my understanding. But
why would Fidelity believe that? I mean, it seems to me if he has a half interest in a Fidelity account, that's worth some sort of money right now. I can understand how he would get the money, but it would have to be his estate now that gets the money. I mean, he's never designated to anybody what should happen to that half in the event of his death, has he? I mean, my understanding is there's no will here.
There is no will, and I mean, I'm confident the investment firms would be able to do that. If he's got extra money coming into his account and he's got three beneficiaries or four beneficiaries designated, they'll divide up that extra. That's my understanding, but I'm from all my conversations with them, but I don't know. But certainly appellant's argument that I should be the appellant, that Ms. Malloy should be able to go and work with the investment companies and get disclosed and have disclosed to her all this, and that there's no law for that.
Well,
there's no law.
Why wouldn't that be the case for any of the beneficiaries? There are four beneficiaries here. Why wouldn't any one of them be entitled to find out what exactly Mr. Miller owned so they know whether they got the right amount?
Well, they might be. I mean, they can do whatever the investment firms are under their policies will share with them. That would be fine. But for Ms. Malloy to have a court order that she gets some kind of oversight power, then I mean, if the court were to do that, they'd have to give it to all the beneficiaries.
Isn't she just in this on behalf of her daughter?
Pardon me?
Isn't she just here representing her daughter's interest?
Well, she's not the only beneficiary to Mr. Miller's accounts. My daughters are all beneficiaries, too. And
right.
They could have filed a motion to intervene, correct? I mean, it's...
Well, I think to intervene was to stop my order. But this is a different... This is... The motion to intervene doesn't then give her the right over all the other beneficiaries to say, well, hey, I'm in charge here, and I get to oversee.
Where in appellant's brief do they argue that they're in charge and they get to oversee?
Well, I have a whole section in my brief addressing that. So I address it. It's their alternate motion to intervene. If the court denies their motion to intervene, this is our alternate argument. They didn't even address that. They didn't even bring that to the district court.
So in your brief, you rely on the Luthen case, and isn't this case distinguishable from the Luthen case? Because in the Luthen case, there was an express determination that the child failed to show a vested interest in the marital assets. But here, the child has a vested interest in one of the in the retirement accounts.
I disagree, Your Honor. It's not vested. It's not vested because of the Hall versus Reynolds, the Sand, the Larson case.
But so the under the decree, you're entitled to 50% of your ex-husband's retirement accounts, not 100%. So the other beneficiaries have an interest in his retirement accounts, correct?
Yeah, but of the half. And so,
right. But
are
so
you,
don't they have a vested interest in some portion of the account?
She doesn't the have a vested interest in the part that vested interest is there if the divorce judgment and decree is enforced. So she does not have a right to intervene to try to get her 40% of the 100%. So Luthen applies because she's seeking to intervene to assert her argument that the statute of limitation precludes the district court from enforcing the judgment and decree. So it's the same thing.
Couldn't your ex-husband have asserted the statute of limitations if he were alive and you brought this action 14 years after the decree? You brought the motion to enforce the judgment 14 years after the decree?
I think that all the facts that we have, and I went through them in my affidavit. My daughter submitted an affidavit about her conversations with her father. There's no evidence that Mr. Miller was planning on not dividing the retirements. So I'm confident that, no, had I submitted them then to when he was alive, he would not have asserted the statute of limitations.
But why don't each of the daughters just step into his shoes? Why can't they be defending and asserting his interest the same as he could have if he were alive?
So you're saying that the daughters get to intervene to stop the...
Right. I mean, he had an interest in all of these IRAs, and he died without a will. I don't know anything about the rules of intestacy in California, but I certainly suspect that children of a decedent are heirs under that law. And here it's clear that at least for some of these IRAs, all four of the children have been designated as beneficiaries. So they, all four of them at a minimum, have that interest in the property that he owned when he was alive. Why don't they just step into his shoes in this action now to determine what that actually is worth?
Well, in his shoes, he was not going to, again, there's no evidence that he would, that they would be stepping into his shoes to assert the statute of limitations. On that issue, I do just want to give the site of Ellis versus Doe, which is a new Minnesota Supreme Court analyzing the meaning of the word proceeding in action in 924 Northwest 2nd, 258, 2019. And the court says that an action and a proceeding is the broad definition. It's from the beginning to the end. It is not just one step in the proceeding, which would make the statute of limitations not apply here because my motion to enforce the decree is not an action. And I think this case is really important because,
could I ask one final question? Do the parties here all know the values of each of these IRAs?
My daughters had paperwork, if they know. They know vaguely how much he had in his accounts, yes.
Do they know how much you have in yours?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
I respectfully ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Any rebuttal from appellant?
I'll start by addressing the last question that the court asked of the respondent. We do not know how much respondent has in her accounts. That has not been disclosed. We did try to serve discovery on that issue to find out, and the respondent obtained somehow a decision of the court saying she doesn't have to respond to that. So it's never been disclosed. We don't
know. I don't understand what this what the controversy is here. It seems to me that you agree that each of the parties to the marriage owns one half interest in each of these IRAs at the time of the divorce. Am I wrong about that?
I think that's what the decree said. Yes. The only dispute that I have with that, Your Honor, is just that I think that the right of either party to try to enforce that provision of the decree has now expired.
So you're saying that regardless of what the decree said, the passage of 10 years, it just becomes meaningless.
That's an interesting way to put it. I wouldn't quite put it that way. I would say that the statute of limitations applies to bar a party from coming back to court and trying to enforce it. And that's exactly what the motion is.
If the statute of limitations doesn't apply because of paragraph 36, do you agree that the order requires both parties to transfer 50% of their retirement income accounts as described by Ms. Spera?
I do, Your Honor. And in fact, I said so at the district court. What I said at the district court was, Your Honor, referee, if you're going to do this, what we need to do is figure out what was in the respondent's accounts back in May of 2014 and what was in the petitioner's accounts in May of 2014. Basically offset those values and take the difference and transfer it one way or the other. If we're going to proceed with this, that's what should happen because that's what was contemplated by the decree. I mean, it was sort of, it was oddly written. I wouldn't have drafted it that way, saying I give you half and you give me half. I think I would have just said offset and pay me the difference. But in any case,
what probably happened had they done this within 30 days.
Right. I think that's ultimately
didn't happen.
There wouldn't have been all these transfers back and forth. I think they would have just figured out what the difference was and moved it. And that's what should have happened. But it didn't. And the right of both parties to come, either party to come back and make that happen and get a court order to enforcing it has now expired. Minnesota courts have clearly held that the statute of limitation applies to all judgments. That's Dahlin v. Croning. They've expressly held that it includes divorce decrees. That's Dolly v. Nichols cited in our case. We've cited a number of cases.
Ms. Spera just pointed us to a recent Supreme Court case. Does that case suggest that this motion to enforce the judgment as part of the same dissolution action that was started a number of years ago?
Well, first, I must admit I am not familiar with this new Supreme Court case that she cites, so I have not read it, and I'm not sure of its import yet. But I think the argument that at least was made in the respondent's brief was, well, the statute of limitation doesn't apply because this is not an action. And our argument is it most clearly is an action. This is most, an action refers to a judicial proceeding, and this most definitely is a judicial proceeding. I can't remember the cases off the top of my head, but they're cited in footnote 6 of appellant's original brief, which gives the court clear law over many years about that issue. This most definitely is an action, and I think that the statute of limitation can apply. One thing I wanted to point out was, in case the court finds some inequity in this, because that's what the referee said, like, well, this is a harsh result if I don't let the respondent take her half of the deceased petitioner's retirement accounts. I mean, we have to remember that she never transferred her half to him as well. I mean, she got to keep hers.
It sounds like she's agreeing that her half does get transferred to him. Her accounts are in the same investment funds as his accounts, and it sounds like she agrees that pursuant to this order they will be transferred.
You know, Your Honor, and I hope that's true, and if the case is not, if the motion is not denied based on the statute of limitations, hopefully the appellant will be permitted to intervene, and as Your Honor put it, keep things honest. It's very interesting that the respondent's motion seeks to have the accounts valued as of today, as opposed to back in what they were valued at in 2004. That's what the motion says.
What else could be done? I mean, don't we have to deal with the money that's in the accounts now?
Well, we do. And that raises an interesting question because as the last question Your Honor asked was, do we know what's in Ms. Spera's accounts now? The answer is no. And for all we know, the money's been withdrawn. I mean, who knows, right? What if the money's not there now? And that partly goes to our argument about latches, which I don't think is necessarily appropriate to be decided here, but if it gets remanded, I think that's an issue that the district court's going to need to address. Because we don't know that. I want to address just briefly the argument about paragraph 36. I mean, most decrees have requirements that require parties to transfer money or property subsequent to the decree. And of course, the property division in a decree is final. So, I mean, you could argue that anything is, you know, if you're going to say, well, the property division's final, why doesn't the decree operate to transfer it? I mean, that could apply to anything then. And it would basically make the statute of limitation meaningless. It's important to notice.
Time is up. Mr. Cox, if you could conclude briefly, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
I will.
Members have questions?
I appreciate Your Honor's indulgence. I will just say that paragraph 36 does not have any language concerning a waiver. I mean, if the intent was to abrogate the statute of limitations and say this decree operates for time immemorial, you know, it should say that. It doesn't say that. And for all those reasons, we ask that the court reverse the referee's decision and find that the motion is denied by the statute of limitations. And barring that, that appellant at least be permitted to intervene and, as Judge Peterson put it, keep things honest. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. Your arguments were helpful. We'll look carefully at the case and issue our decision within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.